Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's my very pleasant duty to introduce our first inaugural lecture of this academic year, which is to be delivered by Professor David Rubin. David came to the school in 1984, having previously held positions in Edinburgh, Glasgow, Essex, where, in fact, we were colleagues, not only colleagues, we were, I can reveal, fellow members of the AUT committee, and you don't get closer than that, and the City University. Since then, he has authored many articles, published The Metaphysics of the Social World and Explaining Explanation to great tomes, and edited and introduced the OUP Readings in Philosophy volume on explanation. His main interests are in the philosophy of social science and in problems of general metaphysics. His interests have turned to theory of action comparatively recently. He has published several articles in the field and is working on a book provisionally entitled Action and Explanation, which will seek to bring together his previous work on explanation with his current research in action theory. But his interests go wider than this. He's also written a book on the philosophy of Karl Marx, entitled Marxism and Materialism, and published articles in Ethics and Political Philosophy, the Philosophy of Law, and on the Analysis of Causation. But his lecture this evening is what is currently his main interest. And so, David, without more ado, can I invite you to talk to us on Doing Without Happenings, Three Theories of Action.
Thank you, Director. There is a handout, and it will help you follow the score, so I hope you'll have it or at least be able to share it with someone. In the Middle Ages, philosophy was called ancilla theologiae, the handmaiden of theology. Such a conception of philosophy may have been good for theology, but it was certainly not optimal for the philosophers. The tunes to which philosophy danced were played by others. It is not much of an improvement if, for theology, one substitutes natural or social science, for they too play tunes that are sometimes alien to philosophy. Philosophy is a discipline with its own integrity, its own inner dynamic. It has, by and large, played its own tune for nearly 2.5 millennia. Schopenhauer said that philosophy arises out of man's need for metaphysics and for no other more practical purpose. Philosophy is puzzlement about, this is a quote from Schopenhauer, why the world exists and is just the kind of world it is. He goes on to say, it hopes to provide a ray of light that should fall on the obscurity of our being and that we should gain some explanation of our mysterious existence in which nothing is clear. Persons of a more practical bent may never find this of much interest. Schopenhauer also thought that the professoriate, those who, quote, live by philosophy and not for philosophy, were in fact the real enemies of true philosophy. University philosophy, he said, is as a rule mere juggling. Such philosophy of the chair cannot be regarded as serious philosophy, but as the mere jest of it. In this respect, if no other, I hope to convince you that Schopenhauer's judgment on the holders of chairs of philosophy was somewhat too harsh. Of course, situated as they are in a school of social science, it is perfectly proper and appropriate for the LSE philosophers to attend to those philosophical questions which are especially relevant to the social sciences. I, for one, have championed just this. I very much hope that my talk tonight will be seen in this light. But I think that it should always be borne in mind that much of what philosophers do will not be seen as relevant to others, just as much of what others do is not seen as relevant to philosophers. Any institution which conceived of its philosophers as always, or even mostly, having to say things that non-philosophers could see as relevant and applicable to their work would be asking for philosophers who are not necessarily true to the inner logic of their own profession, and hence would be asking for philosophers who, in the end, would be very much second rate. I believe that a central task of a department of philosophy must be the teaching of core philosophy itself, in which I would include, as a matter of course, philosophy of science and scientific method. specialist programs, for example, ones in the philosophy of physics or philosophy of economics or philosophy of social science more generally, are intellectually most fruitful when built around this core activity. The cash value of this, as far as I'm concerned, is the need for philosophers at the LSE to continue offering degrees, undergraduate and postgraduate, in what used to be called single honors philosophy. And in order to do this efficiently, to continue their work in close association with the other philosophy departments of the university. The exact nature of that relationship may change, but that there be some such relationship seems to me to be a prerequisite for our continuing to discharge our duties to our students and to the school effectively. Let me now turn to the topic of this evening's lecture by reminding you of a famous line of Shakespeare. Hamlet says to Horatio, who is newly arrived from Wittenberg for the funeral of the former's father, "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy." Hamlet, whether Shakespeare knew it or not, is describing a difference between two different sorts or styles of philosophy. Hamlet's vision is of a rich and florid reality, full of all sorts of wondrous things. Let's forget, of course, about the ghosts. Physical objects, colors, persons, social structures, consciousness, numbers, meanings, the properties things have, right and wrong actions, justice, beautiful objects, causation, subatomic particles so small that no one could possibly observe one, and so on. The second type of philosophy is represented by the philosophy Horatio seems to have learned in Wittenberg, so let's call it Wittenberg philosophy. Wittenberg philosophy, as Quine put it, likes desert landscapes. The Wittenberg view is more austere than Hamlet's. It need not deny outright that any of those things that Hamlet says exists. They might, for the Wittenberg philosopher, but some only in a sense. And in that qualification lies the rub. The Wittenberg philosopher has a metaphysical or epistemological theory to sell us. If he's an idealist, he will tell us that physical objects do exist, but only because they can be reduced to sets of sensory experiences. If he's a nominalist, he will tell us that properties do exist, but only because they can be reduced to similarity sets of objects. If he's a physicalist, he will tell us that consciousness or pain does, of course, exist, but only because it can be reductively identified with a physical brain state. If he's a verificationist, he may tell us that things are causally related, but that causation is just a certain sort of observable constant conjunction between two types of event, or that scientific theories are true, but only because theoretical statements about unobservables can be translated without remainder into statements about observables. If he is an individualist in the social sciences, he will say that social structures exist, but only because they are nothing else but individuals standing in certain relations. If he's an ethical naturalist, he will assert that actions are right or wrong, but only because for an action to be right is merely for it to maximize aggregate pleasure. Pythagoreans even thought that all else that existed was merely a construct out of the numbers. For all these Wittenberg views, there is some privileged set of things, the physical things or the mental things or the individuals, and then allegedly other entities, thought for some reason to be problematic or troublesome, are shown to be acceptable after all, because in reality, nothing beyond the privileged ones. Hamlet might have replied to Horatio using Bishop Butler's maxim, "Everything is what it is and not another thing." G.E. Moore inscribed Butler's saying in the Fronts piece to his 1903 Principia Ethica. As a principle of logic, Butler's maxim is uncontroversial, if we discount its somewhat confused rejection by Hegel. But of course, Moore did not mean merely to subscribe to such an anodyne logical truth. The argument is about what counts as a bona fide other thing. The Wittenberg philosopher asserts that some things aren't really other than something else after all, since the former can be reduced to the latter. This his opponent denies. Moore, for example, set out to show that goodness was an unanalyzable, simple property which could not be identified with a natural property like pleasure. Moore used Butler's maxim as a philosophical slogan, as a way of marking his rejection of various reductive theories in ethics. All of these Wittenberg doctrines have had their moment of glory in the history of philosophy. I have little sympathy with any of these monistic doctrines. Since I am incorrigibly a metaphysical pluralist, I side with Hamlet. I have written about some of these issues elsewhere, and if there is any red thread that links my various philosophical writings, it has been an anti-reductive defense of something or other in the face of various Wittenberg programs. There is something unexciting about such defenses, and something excitingly programmatic about any Wittenberg reductive proposal, for the latter holds out an offer to simplify our ontic commitments. It's far more interesting to be given what is alleged to be news than simply to be told that there is no such news to be had. Of course, that Wittenberg philosophy fails in one instance is no evidence that it will fail in others. The argument must be joined case by case. But it's worth recalling that, as Stephen Stitch says, things have not gone well for this reductivist project. A plausible case could be made out that in 2.5 millennia of trying, we haven't succeeded in reductively defining anything of any interest. Philosophers will be aware that in the face of such defeats of reductionist programs, many have turned to a different naturalist strategy, that of eliminativism. Concerning that latter option, I have nothing to say in this lecture. I want now to focus only on one case, one which I think has particular interest to social scientists, namely the case of action. On any account, social science studies action. It may study other things as well, for example, social structure, but it is, inter alia, the science of action. Hence, I hope that this case of the perennial Hamlet-Horatio controversy will be seen to be of special relevance at the school. Action poses a problem for the Wittenberg philosopher, who has a physicalist or naturalist metaphysics to sell us. There seems to be a distinction of some sort between actions on the one hand, like my bending my finger, my raising my arm, and mere passive events that occur on the other, like my fingers bending and my arms rising. My finger can bend without my bending it. The director might come and bend my finger. I won't have bent it. My arm can rise without me raising it. It seems plausible to suppose that a physicalist or naturalist metaphysics will include physical objects, or whatever natural science makes of them, force fields, space-time points, whatever. Secondly, events which evolve these objects, like the eruption of a volcano, a tidal wave, the bending of an iron bar, the explosion of a supernova, my fingers bending, my arms rising. And finally, third, the causal link that can relate to events. Naturalism can therefore accept physical bodies like mine and yours, and the events that happen to such bodies. The beating of my heart, the growth of my nails, the bending of my finger, the rising of my arm, the fluttering of my eyelid. But where are the actions? Nowhere in such a naturalist metaphysics, which takes its metaphysics to be exhausted by what natural science has to offer, do we find persons and their actions. Unless, of course, we become Wittenberg philosophers and attempt to carry through a Wittenberg-inspired program of reduction for persons and actions. Persons, on such a view, are just to be identified as living bodies or biological organisms, and actions as events of a special sort that happen to those bodies. I have nothing to say now about persons, those agents of the actions that social science studies. Although I take it that persons and actions form a conceptually connected pair, I want only to think now about the nature of action and the Wittenberg view, inspired by naturalism, that actions are just bodily events of some special kind. One might be forgiven for thinking that any such Wittenberg move about action would be implausible. After all, bodily events, like the ones I enumerated above, are passive, since they merely happen or occur. How can some events be actions, which, if anything is, are active? That's the question the naturalist must answer. How can activity emerge from or supervene on the passivity of events? There are two current theories about action which identify every action with an event of some kind. The first is the causal theory of action, and I've listed that as the first thing on the handout. Just, it's easier, I think, to fix on it if you actually see it in front of you. The causal theory of action, which I'll call the CTA. It holds that each action can be reductively identified with a physical movement or event, i.e. some non-actional physical item, but only with one which is caused in the right way by a rationalizing mental state. Various choices here, a belief in a desire pair, or perhaps an intention. In fact, I'm going to speak almost always about belief and desire rather than intention, but I think most of what I would say will apply mutatis mutandis to the case of intention as well. So on this view, the action, my bending my finger, is, after all, the event, my finger's bending, when that bending is caused, for example, by my desire for something and my belief that my finger bending will satisfy that desire. The causal theory of action must admit psychological states, like belief and desire, into its scheme of things, but of course it is free at a later stage to be reductive about them in turn, identifying them with states of the brain. I do not consider this further move here. The idea of rationalization in play here, the idea of mental states rationalizing an event or an action, is the old Humean idea of instrumental rationality. Suppose I desire some end or goal, G. Perhaps I want to impress this audience. And I believe that only by engaging in action A, perhaps by bending my finger, will I obtain my goal of impressing the audience. So my doing A is thereby rationalized. For my action to be rationalized, it's not required that I consciously engage in such practical or instrumental reasoning, but it certainly is required that I do actually have the belief or desire in question, if they are to be the causes of my behavior and be responsible for upgrading, as it were, the finger's bending to the level of action, my bending my finger. The requirement that the mental states rationalize is added by the CTA to the requirement that they cause the event, and is intended to solve the problem of passivity. Causation alone can't solve this problem. The reply of the CTA to the problem of event passivity is that the activity of an action can be located in the type of causes it, or equivalently the event with which it's identical, has. When my finger bends as a non-deviant result of my rationalizing belief and desire, that is agency enough, says the CTA. An event so caused just is an action. I desire G, and I believe that only by bending my finger will I get G, so when that desire and that belief jointly cause in the right way the bending of my finger, such a bodily movement is my action, my bending my finger. It should not be imagined that any version of a CTA can jettison or weaken the rationalizing requirement in any way. There is no chance at all of locating agency or action simply in bodily or other events, as in when driven by just any old psychological cause, if the latter is non-rationalizing. My eyelids flutter, and the fluttering is caused by an embarrassing thought or by my irascible temperament. I can't always get agency, my fluttering my eyelids, out of the passivity of events, the fluttering of my eyelids, and their psychological causes, the embarrassing thought or the character trait of irascibility. The fluttering of the eyelids might only be a reflex effect of the embarrassment, like the dilation of my pupils is to the absence of light. What is missing in these examples, according to the CTA, is that these psychological causes, irascible personality, embarrassing thought, desire by itself, don't rationalize as well as cause. Psychological causes have no hope of conferring the status of action on an event unless they rationalize the token action. Now, it's important for my subsequent argument to see that desires by themselves are insufficient for rationalization and cannot on their own convert, as it were, events into actions. My desire to flee a foe may cause my heart rate to increase. The increase in heart rate is an occurrence that happens to me and not an action. Causation by a desire alone does not ensure that this is something the person does. So even if mental events like beliefs and desires were in turn to be reduced to physical brain states, the CTA is committed to finding, at the level of mentalistic folk psychology itself, some mental occurrences that cause and rationalize each token action. Hence, assuming that we engage in a great deal of genuine activity, the demands of the CTA will also require of agents an implausibly rich mental life. The CTA must inflate the mental as a precondition for reducing action. Its slogan might be, no action reduction without mental inflation. In this way, the CTA is engaged in dramatic mental overpopulation. I count myself amongst the friends of mind in action. In my view, the friendliest thing one can do in the case of action is to prune, but not, of course, eliminate, the mind's contents. If the CTA can be said to inflate the mind in order to reduce action, I prefer to deflate mind's contents to preserve action's integrity. So as a friend of action, I wish to practice some form of mental birth control. Mental life, on my view, is simply not rich enough to ensure that there are sufficient mental states on hand to meet the requirements for the reduction of action, like those advanced by the CTA. What grounds do I offer for thinking that the CTA overinflates the mind? I grant the CTA its right to postulate all sorts of dispositional, subconscious, and unconscious mental states. The mental states it hypothesizes need not all of them be open and transparent to consciousness itself. However, there will still be insufficient mental material, whether episodic or dispositional, conscious or subconscious, explicit or tacit, to make the CTA plausible. Why so? It seems to me very difficult to draw a sharp, non-arbitrary line between cases of a person being in a mental state like a belief, but of which he is unaware, and cases of his not being in that sort of mental state at all. Nor do I think that there is any reason to draw such a sharp line. But I do think that there are clear cases of action which are preceded by no belief on the part of the agent, however widely that term is to be construed. In order to focus the discussion, let me introduce a distinction between technique and strategy. In playing a complicated game like tennis, this is all by hearsay, I might add, both strategy and technique are in play. The technique is apparent in the player's knowledge of how to hold the racket, how hard to hit the ball, and so on. But a great deal of strategic thought is also involved. Where to hit the ball so that one's opponent will be incapable of returning it, whether one should use one serving technique rather than another in a particular situation, and so on. I wish to concentrate on stretches of skilled activity that involve only technique, or anyway come as close to this ideal as is possible. For this, I will use two examples, a swimmer front crawling across a pool and a speaker producing a series of phonemes that make up a meaningful English sentence. Happily, I have direct experience at least one of the examples. To be sure, the guidance that directs these activities has been hardwired in some way. Of course, I'm not denying that. Further, it goes almost without saying that plenty of other mental states are required, even in the case of technical know-how. The agent must be subjected to, perhaps even bombarded by, perceptual cues of various sorts, which in combination with the hardwired guidance and with various standing desires lead to his skilled activity. But the requisite beliefs seem distinctly lacking. We can describe the difference between hardwired guidance and belief by using a distinction due to Daniel Dennett between personal and subpersonal states of a system. There are, in such cases of technical skills, to be sure, subpersonal informational states that are neurophysiologically realized in the agent. These states represent how things are to be done. But such representations may be non-recoverable by the agent, who might lack any concepts by which to express this information. It may be that he cannot say what he does or why he does it. Such subpersonal states are really no more than physical states that confer on a person certain of the abilities that he may have to do various things. The person has the ability to front crawl, produce certain sounds, and does so. A person may have, in virtue of his hard wiring, an ability to say, do A, which he cannot conceptualize or represent in any way to himself. Whatever such an ability is, it's not a rationalizer. The ability to do A cannot rationalize doing A. Mere physical abilities have no place in the folk psychological arena, which includes rationalization. If there's to be rationalization or rationalizing causes, there must be belief as well as desire. But beliefs require conceptual content. There are no appropriate beliefs in these cases to couple with the desires to do the rationalizing, because no information has reached the conceptual or personal level. And without rationalization, the case for the CTA offering an adequate analysis of action simply collapses. Notice that this point, if it works against ascribing belief to the agent, also works against ascribing corresponding intentions to him. Intentions also require conceptual content. No one can have an intention to do something for which he has in principle no concepts. Suppose that you know how to front crawl or ice skate or sound the English th, but that I do not. That ubiquitous friendly neurophysiologist, well known from his recent work with the brain in the vat on Alpha Centauri, hooks me up with the appropriate electrodes to the informational storage system in your brain with a long lead so that I can move about freely. He provides me with an on-off switch so that I can switch the wiring on and off when I want. The point of insisting on the on-off switch is to make it clear that I remain in control of what I do. The wiring goes from your informational states direct to my motor apparatus, bypassing my brain, but allowing your information to combine with my desires in order to jointly cause my action. It's important to the examples that the wiring does not work by duplicating in me the same informational states that exist in you. I make direct use of your informational states, but have nothing of my own relevant to the activity in which I'm engaging. Variations on the same theme are possible, but all make the same general point. A famous ice skater, or an Olympic swimmer, or an English teacher sells a program and a piece of hardware which straps onto one's back. With it operational, I can ice skate or front crawl or pronounce the th sound as well as he can. My technique is as good as his, and unsurprisingly so, since I'm utilizing his information on how to do what I'm doing. I can turn the device on and off. There is no doubt that in these cases it is I, not you, who am acting. Action must be under the agent's own control. Although I utilize your informational states, what I do is under my control. I control the backpack module or the wiring system that links me to your brain. Now I too can ice skate or front crawl or pronounce English words professionally by tapping into your information. It does not really matter when the agent acts whether these subpersonal information states are actually in him at all. That's the point of the example. It does not matter whether I take advantage of your information or of my own. I could find myself skating or swimming professionally or pronouncing English words faultlessly, surprised at my marvelous technique and unable to say why or how I do what I do. There is in such a case no plausible kind of rationalizing going on that will be of any use in explicating agency. Your neurophysiologically hardwired information, coupled with my desires, can't be whatever it is that confers agency on my movements. There are, to be sure, several lines of defense that the CTA might try. For example, there is Goldman's maneuver, which we might call gross action individuation, so that a whole stretch of activity counts as the basic action, going for a swim, and the action subparts, like front crawling across the pool, are somehow encompassed by the more general belief and desire pair that rationalizes the gross or large action. I don't have time to develop these arguments here. For parties interested in the details of this, please apply within. In the prosthetic cases that I have described, the desires are still mine. One cannot simply locate the desires, conceptual or non-conceptual if such there be, in another person without losing agency altogether. But to be acting at all, I do not need to be acting on any of my beliefs or information. Belief, it seems to me, is quite peripheral to agency, not central to it in the way in which desires are. But in those cases in which the agent has neither belief nor information of his own, his desires can't rationalize his actions on their own. There is action without belief, no need to overpopulate the mind by inventing psychological states like beliefs or like intentions when none are required. The CTA, in my view, fails in its account of agency. The second theory about action, and that's on the page in front of you, is the agent causalist theory, hereafter the ACT. The agent causalist theory disputes a central contention of most views about causality, namely the thesis of event causation, which I've also listed on the page. The thesis of event causation says this: the causal relation always relates events, or states of affairs or facts, these differences being unimportant in the present context. So what the causal relation always does is relates an event. So, for example, there being a short circuit caused the fire. The short circuit is an event, the fire another event. The causal relation on this view always relates to particular events. Of course, even the event causation thesis can accept that statements like the following are meaningful. Truth, of course, being a different question, but they're meaningful. John caused me to leave the party. The brick broke the window. God created the universe. These three statements seem to attribute causal efficacy to substances or agents. What the event causation thesis requires is that such statements be equivalent to some statement which asserts that some event involving the substance or agent, perhaps John's obnoxious behavior, the brick striking the window, God's willing there to be a universe, some event caused the party leaving, the window breaking, and the creation of the universe, respectively. For the ACT, on the other hand, there is, in addition to event causation, another quite distinctive kind of causation, namely agent causation. A person can cause or bring about something, in a sense, irreducible to event causation. And although I'm going to, in a minute, produce a criticism of the view, and I don't think the view holds up, I have tremendous respect for the view. I think it's an interesting view and worthy of serious consideration. The ACT asserts that there are or can be true assertions which attribute causal efficacy to persons, and that such assertions cannot be understood in the reductive way which the event causation thesis requires. On the ACT, actions can be understood using this idea of agent causation. An action is an event brought about or caused by a person. On some versions, an action is an event a person brings about on purpose. So the on purpose gets added in some versions. An agent, I take it, just is a person who is acting. So now we can distinguish between the mere event of my fingers moving and my moving my finger. According to the ACT, the latter, but not the former, is an event that I, and not just one of my rationalizing mental states, bring about. I bring it about, in an unreduced sense. My bringing about an event must be sharply distinguished from my brain state bringing it about, or even my belief and desire or intention bringing it about. In action, on this view, I, but no proper part of me, like a brain or mental state, is causally responsible for the event. If the CTA is fairly thought of as a naturalistic conception of agency, the ACT can be said to be motivated by non-naturalistic sentiments. Unlike the CTA, its motivation is not really Wittenberg philosophy. The ACT's idea of irreducible agent causality is, of course, nothing like any causality that exists in the natural world. Moreover, it does not have the problem that the CTA has in explaining activity on the basis of the apparent passivity of events. The idea of an agent making something happen is intended to capture the idea of activity. The greatest difficulty with the ACT seems to me to be this. For the sake of argument, I assume that what a person agent causes is, for example, the movement of his hand. It will not make any difference if what the person agent causes turns out to be his own cerebral activity, which is another possibility. Since the hand movement, which is his moving his hand, is an action, it must be for the ACT agent caused. It's also an event. It's the moving of the hand. Is that hand movement also event caused in addition to being agent caused? Well, there's a dilemma. Let's look at both horns. If it's event caused as well as agent caused, it will be causally overdetermined, having a cause of each of the two kinds. We seem to be landed on this horn of the dilemma with an odd form of causal overdetermination in the case of every action. Every action would be overdetermined since the movement that the person agent causes will be both agent caused and event caused. It's no longer clear what intellectual work agent causation is doing on this view if we could explain and predict every action by its prior event causes alone. The alternative course would be for the ACT to deny that the hand movement is event caused, since it is agent caused. On this horn, the two forms of causation compete. Nothing can be both agent caused and event caused. The problem with taking this course is that it leaves the theory a hostage to empirical fortune. We believe that, as a matter of fact, there are, in his cerebral activity, event causes for the event, a person's hand movement. Is it that the cerebral activity is allegedly agent-caused and hence has no event causes? This, too, seems implausible. Well, let's pause now and take stock. We have found reason to reject both leading theories of action, the causal theory of action and the agent-causalist theory. Might it be that in spite of their differences, they share a common feature that makes them more similar than one might otherwise have supposed, and which accounts for the defects in both? It was a rhetorical question. You won't be surprised to hear that my answer is yes. The CTA asserts that every token action is identical to a token event with a certain causal history in terms of the agent's mental states or events. The ACT asserts that every token action, every particular action, is identical to a token event which is brought about directly by a person on purpose. Notice the shared assumption, and I've listed those on the page also. Assumption A, every token action is identical with a token event of some kind or other. That is, on both theories, an action is an event of some type. Once A is granted, the dispute between the CTA and the ACT seems somewhat local. They disagree on how to characterize the event type. As I said earlier, the CTA is regarded as a naturalistic theory of action. Suppose one wanted to develop a theory of action which had some credentials to being non-naturalistic. On reflection, the ACT would be an implausible candidate just because it shares assumption A with the CTA. If a naturalistic theory identifies an action with some event, a plausibly non-naturalistic theory would deny that there is any event with which an action is identical. Compare naturalism and non-naturalism regarding the mind. Non-naturalist theories of the mind do not differ with the brain-mind identity theory as to which physical events, mental events are identical. Rather, they deny all identity claims between the physical and the mental. So I want to deny all identity claims between actions and events. If A were true, then a fortiori so would be B. Whenever anyone acts, it follows that an event occurs. It's also on the page. It's B on which I wish to concentrate. B is weaker than A. B is an assumption made not only by theories which identify the particular action with an event, but also by theories which identify that action with anything which includes an event, or with an instance of a relation whose relata are events, and so on. Someone who holds B, since it's weaker than A, might or might not identify the action and the co-occurring event. Most standard accounts of the problem of action build B into the very way in which the action is understood, even before developing any positive theory of action. That is, most accounts of action assume B above for all cases of action. Particular examples of action, when given, are meant only to be illustrative of the general point. The necessarily co-occurring event is often called the action's event result. For example, David Hamlin says, quote, "It's undeniable that when we make a bodily movement, i.e. when we act, because we make a bodily movement, we act, a bodily movement in the intransitive sense, i.e. an event, occurs. When we move an arm, certain arm movements take place," end quote. And Jennifer Hornsby says that if John moved his body in a transitive sense, then his body moved in the intransitive sense. For obvious purposes, I thought of calling this the Birkbeck assumption, but it seems, since everybody holds it, that would make it too local. Let's call the event whose co-occurrence is supposedly entailed by the action's event result. Events which are the results of some action and events which are consequences or effects of that action should be sharply distinguished, and I think you must see this in order to see the point. Event consequences of an action are contingently related to that action. For example, the effects of my raising my arm might be that a plate is overturned, the soup is spilled, my trousers soiled, and the dry cleaner enriched. Those would all be causal consequences of the action. On the other hand, event results of an action are necessary, on some theories insufficient, for that action. For example, the result of my spilling the soup is that the soup is spilled. That's an internal necessary result. It's not a causal consequence. The action's result is not amongst the action's effects or consequences. It's not a contingent consequence of my spilling the soup that the soup is spilled, but the necessary or internal result of the action. The views I am considering claim that if an action occurs, it follows that its event result does, and hence B, that an event does, and moreover, for the CTA and the ACT, anyway, that the action is identical to that event. So in fact, the CTA and ACT say that the action is identical to its event result, assuming it has a certain causal history. Well, it would be. So an action is identical to its event result. What I want to deny is what Hamlin called undeniable, that whenever an action takes place, so does an event, in any interesting sense. I am not just denying the identity of the action in the event, I am denying that an event must have occurred at all, if an action has. That is, I deny B. Of course, if no event has occurred when an action takes place, then there can be no event with which the action is identical. A presupposition of both the CTA and the ACT will have shown to be false. I do not attempt to prove my view, whatever that might mean, but merely to show that my view is coherent, that there is a place in logical space for it. I do not say that, for example, when Anna moved her hand, that her hand also moved, but that Anna's moving her hand is distinct from her hand moving. That would yield an implausible dualism of action and event to which I do not subscribe. We would have Anna's moving her hand and, in addition, her hand moving. Dualism. Rather, I say that when Anna moves her hand, there is no such event at all as that hand of hers moving. All that there is the action. Let me say something about the qualification in any interesting sense. There are three types of accounts that might be given to the idea of an event, and on two of them, both my thesis and A, the assumption common to both the CTA and ACT, will be trivial, either trivially true or trivially false. The first type of account will characterize events in such a way that it will follow as an immediate and trivial consequence of that account that actions such as runnings, jumpings, throwings, hand raisings, finger bendings, all will count as events, along with volcanic eruptions, sneezings, and hurricanes. I call this first type of an account a wide account of events. Every explicit theory of events with which I am acquainted yields this wide and undifferentiated notion of an event. Suppose, for example, that one thinks of an event as an exemplifying of a property at a time by an object. Since properties can be both static, owning a car, an example, and dynamic properties, running a race, and since the objects that can exemplify such properties may be persons, a wide account of events trivially includes actions. On this type of characterization, a wide account, the action, Sophie's raising her arm, counts as an event. On this first type of account, it is then trivially true, A, that every action is identical to an event, or B, that an event occurs whenever an action does, since every action is identical to itself and co-occurs with itself. My denial of B would therefore be trivially false. I construe the view that actions are events in the above quotations from Hamlin and Hornsby as utilizing event in this wide and anodyne sense. In virtue of this wide sense, there is an entailment of her hand moved from she moved her hand, and this is, I take it, quite beyond dispute. But this is of no help for the CTA or the ACT, for if this were all that there were to it, part of their case would be assured not by honest philosophical labor, but by classificatory fiat. There's a second type of account of events, which I call a narrow account of events, and on which it follows as an immediate and trivial consequence that actions do not count as events. For example, such an account might characterize an event as, inter alia, a non-actional or passive item. On this account of event, A and B would be trivially false, and hence my denial of B trivially true. But again, the result would be not by honest philosophical labor, but by classificatory fiat. But if the CTA and the ACT are worthy of consideration at all, there must be a third account of events, such that the question of whether, for every action, there is some event with which it's identical, is a non-trivial question. Let's call this type of account a neutral account. Once one possesses such a neutral account, it will be clear in very many cases which items are in the extension of the term event. Otherwise, the account would not be offering any stable core meaning to event at all. Consider the set A of all those items which are clearly events on such a neutral account. It must then be a matter of further philosophical reflection whether every action is identical to some event in set A. I deny that A and B are truths and that every action has an event result when event is given its meaning by such a neutral account. The idea of an event in the sense given by some neutral account is conveyed by means of examples. Items which are explicitly included as events in this sense are my fingers moving, my hands waving, my eyes blinking, my arms going up. On the other hand, the following items would be neither explicitly included nor explicitly excluded: my blinking my eye, my moving my finger, my waving my hand, my raising my arm. If the four latter items are to be included as events, it's not an explicit matter of classification, but a matter of philosophical argument. Once we fix the core extension of event in the neutral sense, we ask whether actions can be identified with events clearly in that core. If so, then actions are events in the neutral sense. If not, as I have argued above, then actions are not events in the neutral sense. Of course, one can continue to think of events as the union of the core events and actions unreduced, but that's to switch from event in the neutral sense to event in the wide sense. So what I deny is that an event, as specified in a neutral account, necessarily occurs if an action does. Of course, it also does not follow that no event occurs. In that sense, the entailment fails. So in the neutral sense, when Sophie moves her hands, it's false that Sophie's hand moved. Her hand did not move since she moved it. Henceforth, I intend the meaning of event to be fixed by some neutral account, unless otherwise specified. I take this point to be standard fare in philosophical arguments about identity, whenever the identities are not intended as analytic or a priori truths. Consider, for example, a mind-body identity theory. It says, roughly, that for every mental state, there is some physical state with which it's identical, thinking of the token-token version. What's the meaning of physical here? If the physical is given a narrow account so as to exclude the mental by definition, the thesis will be trivially false. If the physical is given a wide account, for example, whatever a true science assumes to exist, the thesis will be trivially true because mental states are assumed by psychology and every mental state is identical to itself. One will need a neutral account of the physical so that whether or not every mental state just is a physical state is a non-trivial question, answerable only upon further philosophical and empirical reflection. Tim Crane and Hugh Mellor have made us aware just how difficult it may be to produce an account of the physical that will not yield at once a trivial answer. But surely someone may say, when Simon moved his hand changed its place. So when he moved his hand moved, and his hand's moving is an event. Who can deny that? My reply is predictable. When Simon moved his hand, there was an event, his hand's moving, only in the wide and anodyne sense of event. So there is a sense, the wide sense, in which it's robustly true that his hand moved when he moves it. But in the neutral sense, his hand did not move when he moved it. Or anyway, so I assert, and the point is that my assertion is neither trivially true nor trivially false. So if one's hand changed place, it does not follow that it's moved in the neutral sense, since it might change place because one has moved it. His hand moved, where a movement is an event in the neutral sense, is made true by an event, but by no action. He moved his hand is made true by an action, but by no event in the neutral sense. In that sense, when Simon moved his hand, it's false that his hand moved, true only that he moved it. His hand changed place is made true by the disjunction, either he moved his hand or his hand moved in the neutral sense. Compared with the ACT, my view has the advantage that as far as it goes, it can remain neutral on the question of whether all acts have causes, and if so, what kind of cause that might be. There's room here for indeterminism, but certainly it's not required. If an action were an event, the ACT would be inclined to introduce both an event cause and an agent cause for one and the same item, because the action is an event on the ACT. On my view, since no action is an event, there is no need to import both types of causation for one and the same item. Actions certainly have event effects, and if no agents per se are causes, actions themselves might or might not have ordinary event causes and therefore be links in ordinary causal chains. These are issues separate from the account of action itself. My account of action can provide a plausible alternative to the volitional theory of action, at least to Hugh McCann's version of this theory, which is what I'm thinking of. The volitional theory, like mine, is or can be non-reductive regarding action. It need not try to make agency appear out of the mere passivity of events. The volitional theory claims that every action basically is or is caused by an act of will or trying. It is from willing or trying, which are themselves mental actions, that all cases of agency stem. It locates basic action, or action under its basic description, inside the agent in his mind or brain. Assuming that there are lots of things an agent does, there will have to be, on this theory, an awful lot of tryings or willings around as well. Wittgenstein asked, what's left over if I subtract the fact that my arm goes up from the fact that I raise my arm? Recall that actions typically, although I've argued not always, have event results, as well as event consequences. Now, whenever an action has such a result, as well as a consequence, Wittgenstein's question arises. What more is there to my raising my arm than just my arm's rising? My giving the signal is, on this view, just the event consequence that a signal has been given, brought about by some action of mine, like raising my arm. But what about the action, my raising my arm? For any theory which accepts that that action too has an event result, namely my arm's going up, so there'll be an event there, there must be some more basic action, or logically more basic description of that action, such that the event of my arms going up is an event consequence of that more basic action, or of the same action under its logically more basic description. So if, one, every action has an event result as well as an event consequence, and two, Wittgenstein's question, whenever an action has an event result, it cannot be basic or cannot be basic as described, there would be an infinite regress in the analysis of action. To avoid this, we shall have to find basic actions or basic descriptions of actions which have no event results whatever and which bring the regress set up in trying to answer Wittgenstein's question to a halt. Note that on the volitional view, there must be some acts, namely the basic ones, or ones under their basic descriptions, with no event results whatever. With this much, I am in agreement. In fact, my view is really closest, I suppose, to a volitional theory. That is, in my terminology, when such an act occurs, it does not follow that any event does. My view and the volitional view agree that A and B are false and agree that some actions, although they may have contingent consequences, must themselves be resultless because there are no events. But according to the volitional theory, no physical action can be basic since, and this is a quote from McCann, bodily actions like moving a finger always have results. That of moving a finger is that the finger moves. End quote. Basic actions or actions under their basic descriptions will turn out to be mental acts of thinking or willing, basic because resultless. Again from McCann, that acts of thinking do not have results means that there can be no action result problem about them. There can be no action result problem about thinking. If there is no result to be distinguished from the action, there can be no question as to what makes it a result. On this view, no physical action can be a basic action, or no action can be basic under its physical description. No doubt some event occurs in the brain whenever there's a mental action, but the brain event will not qualify as the mental act's result since its connection with that act is contingent rather than necessary, or anyway, so their story goes. I think there's a problem here, but it's not my problem. It's the volitional theories. I do not dispute that there are mental acts like thinking, trying, and willing. But other things being equal, it's unattractive to have to hold that on every occasion on which I act, I basically am engaging in a mental act or an act under a mental description, as the view requires. This would lead to the sort of mental overpopulation I've already described. The volitional theory, it seems to me, overpopulates the mind as much as do the CTA and the ACT. One way to break the hold this picture of action has on us that leads to a volitional theory is to distinguish between physical actions like giving a signal and physical actions like raising one's arm. In the case of my giving a signal, there is something I do, raise my arm, whose event consequence is that a signal is given, the latter the event result of my giving a signal. But the same pattern of analysis does not always apply to a physical action like raising my arm. We need not, on my theory, be driven inside the agent to find an act of will as a stopping place to account for action. In this case, description would make a bad guide to metaphysics. Normally, when I raise my arm, there is no event result like my arm's rising that occurs, since B is false. And so, a fortiori, it's not the case that there is something more basic that I must do, which has my arm's rising as an event consequence either. If no event result for my raising my arm, Wittgenstein's question doesn't even arise in the case. In the normal case of my raising my arm, there is no event, my arm's rising, whose occurrence needs to be explained as a consequence of something I do in order to elevate its status to that of an action. So my view, the denial of A and B, for the cases in which I move parts of my body, at least in normal cases, there are special cases where I can raise my hand by doing that, but in the normal case where I just do it directly, my view permits preservation of the idea that some physical actions may be basic actions, or basic as so described. Recall that in the wide sense of event, I granted the entailment of an event occurs from someone acts. In the neutral sense of event, I agree also that this entailment holds if restricted to non-basic physical actions, like spilling the soup or raising the flag. But it doesn't hold for basic physical action. The descriptions of basic physical action, like one's raising one's arm, do not contain event results, for when one engages in basic physical action, it does not follow that any event in the neutral sense occurs, B is false. In conclusion, let me sum up what I think I've shown. I have rejected two theories of action, one that's proposed in the spirit of a naturalist philosophy, and an alternative to it which is not developed in that same spirit. I have found both wanting. I've begun to sketch what I think is a genuine alternative to both by rejecting an assumption that both share and which I think explains at least in part where they both go wrong. I see what I am doing as part of a much larger task, that of developing an overall metaphysics which I regard as a non-naturalist conception of reality. My theory leaves actions unreduced as a basic type of item in one's metaphysics of the world. Not for nothing did I start by saying that I sided with Hamlet rather than Horatio. There are many questions left for me to answer of a metaphysical, conceptual, and epistemic nature. I would, for example, wish to see to what extent my views on actions and events and the so-called disjunctive theory of appearance are two examples of a much more general strategy that can be extended to many areas of philosophical inquiry. I cannot promise you a second inaugural in which I try to answer these questions, for that sounds a bit like trying to be born twice over. But they will be the issues that will preoccupy me in the near future as I attempt to clarify and elaborate the ideas I've touched on this evening. And may I just say in conclusion that many of you will already think you've spotted the mistakes, and it's very hard to absorb what you'll have to say this evening and what I hope will be a pleasant reception for us all. But if you do have criticisms, I would invite you to put them on paper and let me profit by them. So I invite you to do that. Thank you.
Well, the school's been very fortunate in having a number of professors of philosophy, some like Professor Lakatos, who have made tremendous impact on the study of philosophy itself, and others like Sir Karl Popper, perhaps, whose reputation has gone wider than philosophy itself. But it's actually been rather rare to have inaugural lectures by holders of our chairs of philosophy. Both Professors Lakatos and Professor Popper actually managed to die without having got round to it. So whatever you may think of the theory of action, it is indeed rather rare. It is, in fact, that only the second inaugural lecture of a professor of philosophy that the school has ever had. And I think we've also had a very illuminating example of Schopenhauer's thesis that philosophy arises out of man's need for metaphysics and for no other more practical purpose. Whether or not Schopenhauer's judgment on the holders of chairs of philosophy, that their philosophizing is as a rule mere juggling and cannot be regarded as serious philosophy but as a mere jest of it, I suggest we take up in the informal reception to which I now invite you to repair with David and myself, which will be held in the Student Union Cafe in the East Building, which you'll find just across Houghton Street when you leave this building. Thank you very much. And David, thank you very much indeed.